Well met, and welcome to episode 60, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for December the 5th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we kick off our month-long discussion of the first part of Henry IV with the first half of the synopsis of the play. Then we'll finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. So, the first part of Henry IV, the second play in the second tetralogy. I see the links immediately with the preceding Richard II, and I'm finding so much foreshadowing. Willie Boy must have known that he was going to take this all the way to Henry V. All right. Act 1, Scene 1 of the first part of Henry IV opens with the entrance of Henry IV, Bolingbroke from Richard II, and his son, Lord John of Lancaster, the Earl of Westmoreland, Sir Walter Blunt, and others. The king's first words are interesting. "So shaken as we are, so wan with care." This is not a king who is at the height of his powers. At the end of Richard II, Henry had proclaimed a voyage to the Holy Land, to the sepulchre of Christ in Jerusalem. And that plan, at least for the first 40 lines, is still in place. But Westmoreland brings news that Edmund Mortimer, a supporter of Bolingbroke in his usurpation of Richard's throne, has been captured by the Welsh rebel, the irregular and wild Glendower, who now holds Mortimer in ransom. The news isn't all bad, though. The gallant Hotspur, another of Henry's supporters, has won against the Scottish rebellion and taken prisoners of his own. To this news, Henry can only bemoan the fact that Hotspur is a better man and warrior than his own son. Oh, that it could be proved that some night-tripping fairy had exchanged in cradle clothes our children where they lay, and called mine Percy, his Plantagenet. And so we get our first hints of our major oppositional pair of the play, Hotspur versus Harry, or Prince Hal. For the king, if there's a downside to Hotspur, it's that he's reluctant to give his prisoners to King Henry, a reluctance that the king once addressed when Hotspur meets with the king next Wednesday. Act 1, Scene 2 takes us to Henry's Harry, or as we come to know him, Prince Hal, and who has the audacity to call the heir apparent not by his true name Henry, or even his father's nickname of Harry, but simply Hal? Falstaff, of course. The first thing that is readily apparent in the scene is that while the court sequence was told completely in verse, here the participants speak only in prose. Prosaic, too, is the tavern life, drinking, staying up late, sleeping in later, and taking part in the occasional robbery. Falstaff does have a conscience, or at least a conscious state of common morality, as he asks the prince, "When thou art king, let us not that our squires of the night's body be called thieves of the day's beauty." And thus they begin a scene's worth of back-and-forth playful banter, comic but tinged with dark foreshadowing, as anyone who knows the fate reserved for Bardolph and Henry V should know. Into this scene comes another tavern dweller, Ned Poins, who presents the two with a real opportunity for robbery, but our prince cannot abide. "Who, I rob? I a thief? Not I, by my faith." This would make us believe that Hal had not really participated in any robberies before this point, either. Falstaff gives Prince Hal some grief for his refusal, but Poins says that if Falstaff will leave them alone for a moment, he will be able to get Hal to agree. The surrogate father figure Falstaff leaves, and Poins makes good his promise by promising Hal that the two of them will allow Falstaff and the rest of the tavern dwellers to do the initial robbery, but then they too will rob the robbers for the purpose of hearing the most incomprehensible lies that this same fat rogue will tell us when we meet at supper, how 30, at least, he fought with, what wards, what blows, what extremities he endured. And in the reproof of this lies the jest. Hal agrees and Poins leaves, and we are left with a character who, while fun-loving, is still willing to steal. Now how can we abide by this in a prince? Left alone with only us, Hal gives us his thoughts via a verse soliloquy. Remember how Richard II had an almost total lack of soliloquies? Well, Hal tells us that this is all unyoked humor, but it's all an act. "My reformation, glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men think least I will." He's a good guy, he wants us to know, but we still gotta have our doubts. I mean, if his dissolute prince bit is just an act, why can't this one be one as well? And with this question in mind, Act 1, Scene 3 takes us back to the court where King Henry is meeting with the Percys, including Hotspur. The king wants his prisoners, but what Hotspur gives him is an explanation. The original demand for prisoners came on the battlefield from a dandy, a non-warrior, and it's a comically wonderful speech and gives us great insight into Hotspur's warrior mentality. There's only one problem with the speech. Hotspur still denies his prisoners unless Edmund Mortimer is ransomed from Glendower. Now, who is Hotspur to make these demands? Well, he was one of Henry's earliest supporters. But why is Hotspur so interested in Mortimer's return? Easy. Hotspur has married Edmund's sister, so we can understand his desire. On the other hand, we can understand Henry's reluctance to do this. First of all, Edmund, in some minds, has a greater right to the throne of England than does Harry, and we'll get around to talking about that more later in the month on the blog. And secondly, and maybe even more importantly for the moment, Mortimer has lately married the daughter of Glendower, his captor. This would then make Mortimer more likely to align himself with the Welsh rebel leader. Henry doesn't want to hear Hotspur even speak of Mortimer, demands his prisoners, and leaves the Percys to stew. Now, while Hotspur's father and uncle stew, Hotspur himself is boiling over. What follows is a comic scene of Hotspur fuming, going so far as to wanting to drown that same sword and buckler Prince of Wales with a pot of ale, and his family trying to get him to relax so that they can tell him of a plan to unite the Scots with the Yorkists and Mortimer and the Welsh. And thus, Act 1 ends. The opening scene of the second act takes us to Gad's Hill, the scene of the upcoming crimes, Falstaff's robbery of the travelers to Canterbury, and Poins and Hal's robbery of Falstaff. Here we find Gadsil, yes, a character whose name is a homophone for the location. A little confusing, I know. While he's scoping out the scene, scouting it for potential travelers whom he and Falstaff might rob, there is some comic banter with and between some of the workers and the travelers, humor predicated on the audience knowing certain Elizabethan names for objects, potential failure to translate well into the 21st century. Gadsil is joined by the Chamberlain, and they finish casing the joint. Scene 2 takes us out onto the road where Falstaff, Hal, and their crew prepare for the robbery victims to arrive. Poins has hidden Falstaff's horse, prompting the old fat man to exclaim, "A plague upon it when thieves cannot be true to one another!" It's funny stuff. More comic bantering takes place before Gadsil's arrival ahead of the travelers. Poins and Hal then go to cover escape routes, but we know that they're beginning their lying in wait for Falstaff. The robbery goes off without a hitch, and as Falstaff begins to divide the winnings, complaining that the missing Prince and Poins be two errant cowards. Those cowards scare the robbers off with only a call for your money, the joking Prince admitting, "Were it not for laughing, I should pity him." In Act 2, Scene 3, we find Hotspur reading a letter from a possible co-conspirator against the king. The letter's writer shows some concerns, but Hotspur responds to each. It's an interesting soliloquy, unlike Hal's from Act 1, and isn't it interesting that it's these two characters who get the soliloquies? Hal's is a pure presentation of his thoughts to us, the audience. But this speech could be seen as a man simply talking to himself, talking to the letter. Regardless of its form, it certainly cements our view of him, an easily riled man willing to accelerate his rhetoric, for example, from good plot to excellent plot. His discussion of the letter and decision to leave immediately is interrupted by the entrance of his wife, Kate. A good, loving wife, she has noticed a change in his demeanor. For the last 2 weeks, she has been a banished woman from her Harry's bed, as he has been planning for the rebellion. He has grown to thick-eyed musing and cursed melancholy, and reduced to faint slumbers, which are filled with martial vocal exclamations. She knows something is wrong, and fears her brother is behind it, and she tells him to tell her, if he loves her. Hotspur's response is to call for his horse. She threatens to break his little finger if he will not relent. He claims then not to love her, only to then admit his feelings with a teasing, almost flirtatious speech. But he definitively refuses to tell her anything, as she is a woman and she wilt not utter what she dost not know. He does promise, however, that she can follow him to where he is going. The second act's final scene, and here is as good a place as any to mention that both the second act and this scene are the longest of their kinds in the canon, takes us back to the tavern where we see the fallout from the robbers' robbery. But first, Hal admits to drinking with the commons, which he does so well that he has become so good a proficient in one quarter of an hour that I can drink with any tinker in his own language during my life. Like father, like son. Remember how Richard derided Bolingbroke for his popularity? Hal and Poins then pull a prank on a young tapster, Francis, as they wait for Falstaff and his men to arrive. Just before the fat man appears, Hal speaks of his ability to be all humors. But he is not yet of Percy's mind, the Hotspur of the North. He that kills me some 6 or 7 dozens of Scots at a breakfast, washes his hands, and says to his wife, "Fie upon this quiet life, I want work." If Hotspur disrespects Hal for his dissolute lifestyle, Hal is obviously not convinced that the martial life is all there is. This quiet moment of reflection, even disguised as a joking insult, is interrupted by the entrance of Falstaff, who immediately derides Hal and Poins as cowards. As the two egg him on, Falstaff recounts with growing exaggeration their robbery by 50 robbers and the old knight's courageous slaying of at least 7. Hal finally calls the old man on his lies, and without missing a beat, Falstaff claims he did not attack his robbers because he knew Hal was there and it wasn't for him to kill the heir apparent. As the laughter moves to serious discussion of the military uprising and Hal's impending exit from the tavern life, Falstaff offers to allow Hal to practice his returning speech to the king by acting out their reunion. Falstaff's attempts to play Henry are a bust, filled with rhetoric that is self-serving for Falstaff. When they switch places, however, Hal shows how well he can take on the role of any other person, take on the role of a king. While still playing for laughs from the tavern, insulting Falstaff as that old white-bearded Satan, Hal takes on the tone of kingly insult as well, as we shall see in the next act when father and son do reunite. When Falstaff tries to save his own, Falstaff's not Hal's, reputation, by saying, "For sweet Jack Falstaff, kind Jack Falstaff, true Jack Falstaff, valiant Jack Falstaff, and therefore more valiant for being as he is, old Jack Falstaff. Banish not him, thy Harry's company. Banish plump Jack, and banish all the world." To this Hal can only intone ominously, "I do, I will." An incredible piece of foreshadowing, not lost on his fellow actor. But before Falstaff can respond with much to say in the behalf of that Falstaff, a sheriff arrives to investigate the robbery. Before Hal heads back to London, he promises that the robbed will be paid back with advantage. And Hal's time in the tavern, and our Act 2, ends. As Act 3 begins, we move from the tavern and the Prince of Wales, Hal, to the Welsh rebel leader, Glendower, and his estate, where he meets with the Percys and Mortimer. Glendower, remember, irregular and wild, as described by Westmoreland, more than lives up to his billing, claiming that the earth quaked like a coward when he was born. The blunt Hotspur takes every opportunity to debunk the claims, even to the point where his host warns Hotspur that the Welshman doesn't bear these crossings of many men. But Hotspur doesn't take a hint well, and when Glendower claims to be able to call spirits from the vasty deep, Hotspur responds that so can he, or so can any man, but will they come when you do call for them? While comic for the audience, the situation grows uncomfortable for the Rebel Alliance, and when Glendower excuses himself to call the wives into the room for dinner, Hotspur's uncle and brother-in-law take him to task for impolitic speech. While they claim Glendower curbs himself in response to Hotspur, the northern youth is too willful blame, and they warn that while this can sometimes show greatness, courage, it can just as easily be seen as defect of manners, want of government, pride, haughtiness, opinion, and disdain that can loseth men's hearts. Hotspur claims to have been schooled, but we cannot be sure, as the first half of the first part of Henry IV ends. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along this week with our daily blog entries, you've missed out on subjects including Richard II, numbers overall, Richard II wrap-up, new month, bring on Prince Hal, Act 1, entrance and relationship, Act 1, dads and bros, real and fake, and Act 2, the plots thicken. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for December the 5th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.